that they were, never forget that they were slaves, or that their parents were slaves, or their grandparents were slaves. This is always in the back of their mind, and they're always concerned about slavery coming back. So that's going to keep driving them. So at any point at which the peasants decide in any particular area that they are threatened in any way, it's very easy for some local leader of the army or to put together a militia and march to Port-au-Prince and take over the government. So the governments always have this little threat of the peasants will show up at your doorstep, or some of them will, armed, and you'll be thrown out, and they'll put somebody else in. the problem with this, however, is that in the end, nothing changes because of the political pressures on any given president, particularly from the political elite in Port-au-Prince and elsewhere, and because nobody is able to envision Haiti as anything other than an agricultural exporting country, economy. And so they keep moving in that direction. And I'm going to keep saying this all for the next 45 minutes. So, because it's, you know, nobody has the imagination to get past it. So we keep, history keeps repeating itself, to say the least. So after independence, there's a dizzying number of political leaders coming and going as a result of these military coups, accompanied by a certain amount of fighting. Now, all of this changing of governments that goes on in Haiti, one of the things to understand about them is most of them are coups. Most involve some fighting, but mostly they're fighting with machetes. They're fighting with sharpened sticks. They're fighting with very old guns. So people get killed and wounded, but in very small numbers. The Haitian sort of civil wars, if you will, or coups, are way, way, way less bloodthirsty than anything that's going on in Europe or the U.S. Civil War, to pick a really outrageous example, because they aren't that well armed. People talk about, I mean, historically you talk about all these coups, but in the end, you know, people participate in the coup and then they go back to the farm. I mean, it's not necessarily, devastation everywhere and people dead everywhere. So the words we use don't necessarily reflect the reality of what went on in Haiti. The reason that they keep moving around is that there is all this decentralized political power. It's not all in Port-au-Prince. It's in various ports where they're exporting out of, other than Port-au-Prince, where so the merchants there are making money and they have power. The local military people are also, as we'll see, part of this. So the peasants get a certain amount of room to maneuver versus the political elite who refuse to let them participate in the political system, usually on the grounds that the peasants are too ignorant to be allowed to have a say in the government, and the peasants are almost always described in ways that make them look only slightly more competent than children. And they basically need the guidance of the political elites, who basically just want to make money off of them and certainly aren't going to share power with them. And this is also a constant theme in what's going on. Well, that brings us to foreign countries. As I said, Haiti is a constant, it's like three-dimensional matrix, and all this stuff is always going on at once. So it's unfortunately, I can't describe that in space, so I have to do this linearly, so you have to forgive me. Foreign countries, starting with independence, their independence in 1804, the Haitian political leaders want international recognition. They want confirmation that they are, in fact, an independent country, and that people recognize them as an independent country. And, of course, they're very proud of what they've done. They have established an independent country for themselves. They've abolished slavery. They think what they've done is really great, all in the great tradition of the French Revolution. And they think they should be recognized for all of this. And, of course, that's absolutely what's not happening, because the rest of the world has no interest in what they've done. In fact, they're basically hostile to the whole idea. The French, of course, have now understand that they cannot fight their way back and take over the colony, much as they would like to, because they've already tried that, and all that happens is a lot of French soldiers die, and that's a lot of money gets burned up, and nothing happens. So they know they can't get over the fact that they've lost the colony. It's rather embarrassing. And the British sort of get over the loss of the American colonies. The French have a lot of trouble getting past the loss of Haiti. So they're not about to recognize this, the independence of Haiti, which they continue to refer to as a colony. I mean, it's carried on all their maps and all their references and their correspondences as a colony of France, even though obviously it's not a colony of France. It's an independent country. The British and the Americans are not willing to do anything about recognizing Haiti that would indicate in any way that what has happened in Haiti is acceptable, because the Americans and the British are still deeply involved in the slave trade. And they're not going to do anything to encourage slave revolts. and so they're not about to recognize it. They are, however, quite willing to trade with Haiti, since making money is always more important than principles. But they're not about to recognize them. One president of Haiti was responded to the British refusal to grant recognition by striking up a long-running relationship with William Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson, two of the key leaders of the group that ended slavery in the British Empire. His theory was, well, these guys are clearly active abolitionists, and they have a whole bunch of active abolitionist friends all over all over Europe, and not to mention England, and they'll help us because they're sympathetic. And indeed, they are sympathetic, but they can't move the British government in the end. on the other hand, Clarkson, in an attempt to be helpful, brings about one of the first of many ill-conceived agricultural education ventures in Haiti, in which he brings in some English experts on English farming to explain to the Haitians how to farm in Haiti, which is, on the face of it, from our perspective, that's silly. We know better. At the time, of course, if you're an arrogant white person, this makes sense. And the Haitians, of course, have over hundreds of years figured out how to farm the Haitian countryside. It's their land. They're quite good at it. And it's not quite the same as farming in England. The climate is different, among other things. Clarkson brings over some English people to explain how to farm in England to the Haitians. And, of course, they all speak English. None of them speak French or God forbid, Creole. So they have all this translation stuff. And so they try to explain to the Haitians how you use a plow. As I say, this sort of story continues forever. In November of 1825, after some very odd negotiations, the French decide to recognize Haiti in exchange for Haiti paying them an indemnity of 150 million francs for the loss of their property, namely the slaves. this takes a lot of nerve, if you ask me, but one would think that the French ought to pay the Haitians reparations, but that's a whole other issue. Haiti, of course, doesn't have 150 million francs, and so the French graciously loan it to them. So Haiti now has to pay France 30 million francs over 25 years at an annual interest rate of 6%, but the banks add an additional 20% fee just for their graciousness in providing the money. And so only 24 million francs of the $30 million actually goes towards paying the indemnity, and the debt just keeps growing up, going. And the Haitians refer to this as the double debt. They end up paying the French twice as much as they originally were obligated to do. Eventually, the indemnity is reduced from 150 million francs to 60 million francs, but the loans continue, and the repayments are a constant drain on Haiti for decades and decades. Through the 19th century, France economically dominated Haiti, so that when the National Bank of Haiti was created, it was owned by a French bank. It was never a Haitian bank. And that was in 1888. In 1838, it was estimated that about 30% of Haiti's annual budget was spent on servicing the national debt, and 50% went to the military, and that left about 1% for odd things like education. The foreign merchants, as I say, were happy to deal with Haiti, whether there was recognition or not, because they were making money. In fact, it was said that in the 19th century that Haiti had become a state for merchants. The vast majority of the population still lived in rural areas and obviously didn't benefit from this. They did, however, get to pay for it because the Haitian government imposed export and import taxes so that the goods that the farmers are selling out of the country get taxed. So the Haitian farmers don't get for their goods what they would otherwise. And then, of course, the imports taxes are on all of the goods that are being imported that the Haitian farmers are using, and so they get hit both ways, and so they end up supporting a large amount of the government because they can't tax them directly, so they have figured out how to tax them indirectly. The majority, the people who did benefit from this were the German merchants, who were really quite busy, and the French bankers. Most people just focused on living modestly, doing their farming, which they're quite good at, and avoiding any involvement in the government. One's reminded of the blessing for the Tsar in the movie Fiddler on the Roof, God that the rabbi gives when he asks, is there a blessing for the Tsar? He says, oh yes, God bless the Tsar and keep him far from us. The Haitian peasant's view is the Port-au-Prince government should be kept as far from us as conceivable. Another problem that is long-running for Haiti is racism. Now, there's a certain amount of racism within Haiti. Dark-skinned people in Haiti, which is the vast bulk of the population, is looked down on by the lighter-skinned people. And there are disputes over time about too much favor to light-skinned people and back and forth. Early on, one constitution solved this problem by declaring that all Haitian citizens were black, therefore eliminating arguments about who was white and who wasn't. Obviously, by constitutional fiat, everybody is black. Not everybody noticed this, so the discrimination, unfortunately, continues. This is obviously parallels what goes on in Latin America, in the Spanish countries, where, as many of you may know, the lighter your skin, the better off you are. The darker your skin, the more likely you are to end up farther and farther down the socioeconomic scale, and it's much harder for you to to get up. The Latin American soap operas are a riot because the maids in there are all white actresses, and of course there's not a white maid anywhere in all of Latin America, trust me. Haiti has a similar kind of thing going on. Worse than that, from the Haitian viewpoint, is they can handle. Haitians can handle themselves. The foreigners all use racism as a way to explain why they can mistreat the Haitians, or why they don't have to deal with them, or something of the sort. And especially the U.S. Before and after the Civil War, which was not about to admit that a black country like Haiti was capable of running its own affairs, taking care of itself, making its own decisions. Because, of course, if that was true, where did that leave their attitudes about the black slaves or the black freedmen after the Civil War? So there's there are endless books, well, a lot of books written by foreigners explaining how Haitians. They're also explaining about how Africans as well. About how Haitians, you know, being black, are intellectually not capable of doing anything very complicated. They need guidance. They're, you know, they have all of the, they, you know, just one step up from apes. Blah 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 blah. I mean, every racist thought you have ever read are in these books, and they're in the newspapers in Europe, and repeated over and over again. And in part, this is because if you're going to oppress a people, you need, you know, it really helps to have some way to explain to yourself why these are bad people, or why it's okay to oppress them. And if they're stupid, dangerous, ignorant, barely civilized cannibals, et cetera, jungle bunnies, I don't feel so bad when I'm oppressing them and taking money from them, whatever. If they're good, you know, clean, white Christian people, maybe I feel somewhat more concerned about it. So the racism always is an excuse why foreigners feel quite comfortable taking advantage of the Haitians, and also quite comfortable explaining to the Haitians how they should run their country. And in fact, coming in to help them run their country by basically taking as much money out of the place as possible. So that's a long-running problem for the Haitians. Haiti, of course, has produced poets, historians, philosophers, novelists. They have a very vibrant culture there. And now what they're writing, of course, is in French, which would have to be translated into English, so we never see this stuff. But they are a vibrant part of the French language discussion of, you know, life, you know, for humans, you know, on this planet. Finally, in June of 1862, the United States decides to recognize Haiti as a nation. And actually, by the early 1860s, more than 2,000 American immigrants had gone to Haiti because they're very excited about, you know, here these black people have established this colony, whatever, and we are going to go to Haiti rather than staying in the U.S. to participate in this. Also, in 1860, Haiti was at last recognized by the Catholic Church. The Vatican had held out was sort of the last holdout, along with the United States, in terms of recognizing this. Unfortunately, this recognition meant that the Vatican was now free to send a bunch of priests to Haiti. The priests show up wanting to convert people to Catholicism and to moralize them. This confuses the Haitians because many of them thought they were Catholics already. And so the fact that these priests are showing up and saying, no, you're not Catholic, or you're not Catholic enough or something, doesn't make a lot of sense. And furthermore, of course, the priests are not fond of the social conventions within Haiti. Particularly, there's a convention about marriage, which I won't waste time explaining, that still goes on today, which drives the priests absolutely bananas because it does not involve people getting married other than going into the Catholic Church and, you know, saying words in front of a priest. So obviously this can't be real marriage, and therefore we need to put an end to this. So the priests are a disruptive factor as they go around trying to explain to the Haitians how they, the priests, know a lot more than the Haitians do. As the 19th century wears on, the leaders of Haiti become more and more concerned about how Americans and Europeans view them. So they undertake a sort of internal civilizing mission, aiming particularly at voodoo. So as a result, there are trials, there are executions of people who somebody within the government has decided or somebody locally decides is too voodoo-ish or is a voodoo priest or priestess or something or other. Often this is made-up evidence and whatever, but it's okay. We execute them anyways. And this is one of several attempts to sort of beat down voodoo, which never succeeds, but which, you know, manages to make life difficult for a lot of people, if not killing them. Well, by the second half of the 19th century, sort of constitutes the beginning of the arrival of the United States and the exiting of the Europeans. And it takes a while for this to happen, but it gets started. The second half of the 19th century was seemingly a time of constant civil war. Between 1843 and 1889, there were 12 presidents, 8 constitutions, and various amendments to the constitutions. The constitutions being used by the ruling classes to maintain control of the state and divide up the spoils. And so every time somebody new came in, they had a new theory about how to divide up the spoils, so we have to change the Constitution in order to do that. None of this Constitution changing, of course, has anything to do with, God forbid, letting the actual vast majority of the population participate in the political process. Oddly, however, Haiti being Haiti, has stability in the midst of the instability. The government may change, but local political structures in Haiti remain largely unchanged. The military commanders of each district run their local governments and manage the administration of people's daily lives. Many of them stayed in their positions for years, even decades, which provided a certain continuity to the people from whatever silliness was going on in Port-au-Prince. The Haitian army, basically the Haitian army then is being used not to defend the country so much as to run it. And only they become, each of these little areas becomes an independent civil, there are 9 provinces, independent and regions within the provinces. And they all become sort of little independent power centers. And the little independent power centers are not under the control of Port-au-Prince, and so except vaguely. So actually, for most people, you can sort of live your life and not pay a whole lot of attention to Port-au-Prince. Everybody honkers down. They farm their land. They do their very best to be invisible to the government. The only person you have to deal with is the local military commander, who's often, become a friend, joined up with whatever the people in the area. So the Haitian military becomes very important to the life of Haiti. And military service remains the primary route to social advancement. So especially for officers who get not only a salary, but often local power and access to buying land, which is another way to get access to wealth. Now, the end result of this, of course, is that the army becomes bloated, particularly with officers. But that's, no one seems to be able to figure that out. Everybody who comes in puts their own people in. Everybody who becomes president wants to put their own people in charge of the military so they can control them, but they can't get rid of the other people. So you just keep layering more and more officers on the whole thing. So it gets sort of out of control. On the other hand, the army is far from unified or centrally controlled, which again helps protect the citizens from whatever nonsense is going on over there in Port-au-Prince. Furthermore, everyone can participate in an insurrection. Women participate in insurrections, men participate in insurrections. All you need is some sort of little weapon and look at thing, and you too can go and revolt against whatever nonsense they've come up with in Port-au-Prince. You can join up with your local military commander. A bunch of you can march to Port-au-Prince, take over the government, then you go home. It turns out nothing much changes. But you can start an insurrection from almost any place. the effect of this is that the government does not have a monopoly on violence. It does not have a monopoly on, in effect, military power. It's quite spread out, which means that everyone who is president has to be more than vaguely aware of the fact that if you push too hard in one direction, the peasants can come and get you, or somebody can organize a bunch of peasants to come and get you with various slogans about helping the peasants or doing one thing or another. So you have to be careful about pushing too far what you would like to do, is exploit the peasants more and more. The insurrections are relatively short. Most people quickly return to their normal lives. And indeed, the instability is probably viewed by the peasants, which is to say the vast bulk of the population, as an advantage. It helps keep everybody at arm's length. And so even if the state offers very little, which it does to these people, it also lacks the ability to take much away because we have organized, you know, non-power from the center. So in lots of ways, it works for them. And so most rural people, as I say, just focus on their land. They focus on, you know, making a comfortable living from farming, and they're happy. That's all they're looking for. Unfortunately, that's not all that's going on. During this period, also, however, the foreign debts, particularly to the French, keep right on growing. Foreigners, and because of the large debt to the French banks, the Haitian government has to keep borrowing money short term in order to cover its costs. And it borrows money from the French. It also borrows money from other foreign banks. And so over time, the debt becomes greater and greater and greater and chews up more and more and more of the economic resources of the country. And the foreigners, in order to protect their ability to collect on their debts, demand more and more control over various sources of income from the Haitian economy. So the foreigners get more and more involvement in the money flows of the country. Also, all of this allows foreign merchants to be more and more involved in the trading that's going on. Now, some of the merchants, like the Germans, tend to become more involved in Haitian society and to participate in what's going on around them in Haitian society. American merchants almost always stand aloof. They don't want anything to do with these black people, which is somewhat unfortunate. As the 19th century comes, it moves along in the second half, steamboats become more and more important, obviously, to transportation in general and particularly to navies. So the U.S. starts looking for coaling stations, ironically, they decide that Haiti and the Dominican Republic, both of which are independent nations, are the most likely places to take over, to turn into coaling stations because they don't have a foreign government protecting them. So the United States starts talking about annexing Haiti, something which they had talked about prior to the Civil War. That talk has sort of gone away. It's now returned. As a result of all of this attitude of the U.S. towards Haiti, the views of the U.S. by the Haitians begin to suffer. Many Haitian leaders describe the U.S. as hopelessly materialistic, uncouth, even backwards. Sounds like French talking about the English, doesn't it? Not to mention a deeply racist one, which they can tell it when they see it. Nevertheless, some members of the ruling class argue that it was only logical to try to cut deals with the U.S. given its size and its proximity. You can't do anything about either of them, so you might as well just try to deal with it. Some would-be leaders look to the U.S. for aid in their ambitions, leading to lots of charges about who was too close to the U.S. Of note, at one point in the 1880s, the U.S. sent Frederick Douglass, the famous abolitionist, to Haiti as an ambassador, with sort of mixed results for the U.S. and Haiti. For example, in March of 1892, the New York Herald attacked Douglass for being, among other things, black. It argued the United States should send a white ambassador because the Haitians would recognize the superiority of a white hand to guide them. Ah, well. And things like that were in the newspapers all the time, and in articles and whatever, in the U.S. The first sign of how greedy the Americans could be towards Haiti was the passage of the 1856 Guano Islands Act. The farmers in the U.S., among other places, had realized that their land needed to be fertilized, and that it was being depleted by various agricultural techniques they were using. And they had discovered that guano, bird poop, and bat poop, was just a really great way to do this. The main supplier of guano was Peru. But that was expensive, and if you could find guano closer to the U.S., it would be cheaper to ship it. So they start looking around for places with guano that they can control. And one of the places they find is the island of Navassa off Haiti, which was an island that had long been part of Haiti, viewed as part of Haiti, but it wasn't particularly occupied. And so the U.S. had passed this act that said, well, anytime we find an island that we decide isn't occupied, we can take it over because we're the United States. So they showed up and took over the island of Navassa, brought in some Haitians and African Americans to collect the guano and ship it all to the U.S. Now, there's nothing on that island now. It still belongs to the U.S. There's nobody there. But there was a source of income that could have gone to the Haitians, should have gone to the Haitians, but instead, you know, went off to the U.S. Next, the Americans cast their eye upon Mole St. Nicholas. Now, Mole St. Nicholas is here on the far northwestern corner of Haiti. And it's a wonderful port. It's strategically placed where the U.S. ships coming and going would have a really good place to pick up coal for themselves. So the U.S. starts pushing to get control of this this port. And in the early 1890s, the U.S. sent warships into Port-au-Prince to attempt to scare the Haitians into giving the U.S. a long-term lease on the Mole under rather unfavorable conditions. The attempt failed. The president had a lot of nerve. President of Haiti had a lot of nerve and refused to buckle. But also he was helped by the fact that his ambassador to the U.S. sent him a telegram that said, don't worry about the warships. They're just for intimidation. Go ahead. You feel free to resist. So he did, and he got away with it. But the United States still keeps looking at that Mole and thinking it would be a really good place to own. In 1904, Teddy Roosevelt issues what's become known as the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine that claimed that if the United States might need to intervene in a country if it became incapable of guaranteeing its own political stability and therefore was vulnerable to foreign occupation. So it's not just foreign occupation we're going to keep out. It's if you were potentially vulnerable. So the danger of foreign intervention, therefore, would require foreign intervention by us. Finally, after a lot of fooling, fooling around continues on, and the first semi-climax to this, in December of 1914, the United States sends the Marines into Port-au-Prince to steal a Haitian gold supply. That's first Marine organized bank robbery, I suppose, because the U.S. announced that it wasn't sure that the Haitians would be able to pay their debts to the American bankers, and so it would needed to seize the gold to make sure its bankers would get paid. there was, following that, in the next year a coup, which in the midst of which 167 political prisoners were executed, which the United States was decided was a good reason for it to occupy the country. So it occupied the country starting on July 28th of 1915, and we don't leave until 1934. A Haitian expert had to come in and explain to Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, he of the Scopes Monkey Trial, who was where Haiti was. That was the first thing he had to explain to him. So he briefed him on what Haiti was all about and whatever. And when he gets through, Bryan exclaims, "Dear me, think of it, niggers speaking French." As I say, the racism is constant. The United States announces that it's going to do all kinds of good things for Haiti, as Napoleon had announced. But like Napoleon, the United States has in mind only making money for itself and creating business opportunities for U.S. businessmen, many of whom showed up with all kinds of schemes, which in theory were supposed to help the Haitian people, but actually in the end just made money for themselves or their companies. The sugar company was created, came in to start a sugar plantation. United Fruit showed up to start banana plantations. Citibank showed up to try to figure out ways to make money for itself. It was sort of open season. As the Marines spread out over in the city of Port-au-Prince, there was one Haitian soldier who refused to retreat or surrender, and so was shot dead by the Marines, who was a legendary martyr in Haitian history. The United States declares martial law, shuts down newspapers that were critical of what it was doing, and spreads out and acts very much like it's taking over and not going anyplace for a long time. The Marines, unfortunately, had little idea of where they were or what Haiti was about. Their officers told them the Haitians were devotees of voodooism and past ministers of poisoning their enemies and were a throwback to their jungle ancestry. There was also a lot of talk about cannibalism and blood ceremonies in voodoo and how they killed babies and used the blood and sometimes ate babies. All of which is amazingly reminiscent of the blood libel against the Jews that the Christians in Europe used as part of the anti-Semitism. And you can still find articles and references to how at Passover Jews kill Christian babies and use the blood and sometimes eat them. And it's called the blood libel. This is just amazingly, for me, amazingly similar. Furthermore, the Marines were all white. Many were from the South, and generally they had no respect for, let alone understanding, of the black Haitians. Some Haitians, of course, fought back against the American invasion, but of course they're outgunned and in some cases bombed by airplanes. All of this armed opposition, which was fairly low level, leads to killings, burnings of villages, and other outrages that are typical of occupations. Marines would announce that if there was anybody shot at any of their men, the nearby village would be burned or the nearest house would be burned or something of that. And of course, it had nothing to do with whoever did whatever they were concerned about. they can't tell one Haitian from another, and so they tend to treat them badly because they can't figure out who's who. The military, of course, has not enough men, so they try to control the country by fear. They don't trust the Haitian army, so they create their own military force run at the top by American soldiers. They also start hiring spies and paying them for information about, other people. So if you want to make money, you turn in all of your neighbors or the people you don't like. In order to control the country, the Americans destroy all of the decentralized power structures that have protected the Haitian peasants for all these years, and put in a structure where all power runs to Port-au-Prince. Local governments are replaced by Marine officers and non-coms who were basically unsupervised and committed or allowed various crimes against the people, unjustified killings, extreme punishments, and rape. There was a lot of rape, particularly including of young Haitian girls. Since they can't tell really who's somebody who's fighting against the occupation or not, the more sadistic of these Marine characters, officers would go through the market and find two or three people he didn't like and then beat them to death or shoot them on the spot or something of the sort. It's a rather extremely unpleasant and embarrassing American activity. Various U.S. reports before and after the occupation documented all this and were duly ignored. All of this is made worse by the fact, of course, that the Marines can't speak French and they certainly can't speak Creole. So it's just a mess. Within a year, groups of men were put to work on various projects like building roads and stuff that the Americans thought would be a good idea. The workers were basically not paid much. If anything, they were treated badly and many died. And to the peasants, this looks like the return of, this is white people coming back, bringing slavery. You know, makes sense to them. The American businessmen attempt to reestablish the plantation system, which wipes out small farms in various places. Again, looks like more reimposition of slavery. creates, you know, a mess in the economy. And even when they're trying to do good, because they don't understand the language, they don't understand the society, the Americans often make a mess of it. One of the few things that works relatively well is hospitals. The medical things are things you can put down and they don't really require any knowledge of, you know, medicine is medicine. It can be separated out from understanding the society. The Americans instituted harsh measures to end voodoo practices, which continued on, as I say, this continues on until 1934 when FDR, who wants a different Latin American policy, finally ends the occupation. One of the Haitian ways to fight back against this is the Haitians refuse to play baseball. They're the only Caribbean country occupied by the U.S. which does not play baseball. Now, this is particularly ironic because at one point the Haitians made all of the baseballs used in professional baseball in the United States. But they do not play baseball. It's one way to thumb your nose at the Americans. terrible things happen around as well. Like in 1937, Rafael Trujillo, who's the dictator in the Dominican Republic, decides that the Haitians living on the Dominican Republic side of the border are causing trouble, so he sends his troops in to get rid of them. And so over the space of a few days, his troops kill tens of thousands of Haitians. As a way to, you know, ethnic cleansing, you know, that side of the border. it's easy to tear down, especially if you have lots of military force, to tear down the societal structures. It's hard for the societal structures to reinvent themselves. The fact the Americans have left doesn't mean that Haitian society snaps back to what it was. It's sort of left in limbo the way the Americans left it. In 1956, there is a violent year-long struggle to see who would become president of Haiti. And in the end, a relatively unknown doctor, writer, and occasional activist, Francois Duvalier, ends up in control. As one Haitian said, his message was, in effect, no one is untouchable and nothing is sacred. He used the control techniques which the Americans had introduced, and he just expanded on them. His private militia ended up being twice the size of the army because he didn't trust the army. He ruled by random violence and terror and turned everyone into spies against everyone else. There really is no good count of how many tens of thousands of people he killed, but it was a lot. People just disappeared. They would just massacre people for no reason at all. The Tonton Mouchons would show up and just kill people and go, and no one knew why. And so you lived in constant fear of, I don't know what I'm doing. Am I doing anything that will offend any? So, of course, slavish praising of Duvalier and whatever was the only way to stay alive. Duvalier hires PR firms in the U.S. and claims that he's anti-communist and manages to keep the U.S. at bay and even collects U.S. military arms and military aid and other aid. Early 1971, because Duvalier knows he's dying, he gets the Constitution changed to declare his son Jean-Claude Duvalier as his successor. By that time, the terror had been going on for so long that scholars debate if the no votes amounted to one or zero. Everybody just knew you had to vote yes. And they'd learned that from a whole bunch of alleged elections before that, in which voting no ended was not a healthy thing to do. So Papadoc dies in April of 1971. Once again, the United States shows up trying to help. It tries again to turn Haiti into an export agriculture export economy. Once again, this fails to affect in any way the poverty in the country. The U.S. does things like International Development Organization, the U.S. Aid Organization, shows up, and in order to protect the Haitians against swine flu, kills all the Haitian pigs, or gets the Haitian government to kill all the Haitian pigs. One of the Haitians remarked it was one of the few efficient things the Haitian government ever did. Unfortunately, the Americans said, well, don't worry, we're going to bring in the pigs and we'll replace all the pigs. Well, one, they didn't even come close to replacing the pigs, and two, they're replacing them with American white pigs who can't live in the, aren't used to the climate, aren't used to the food, aren't used to anything, so they die like flies. And so all that happens is Haitians end up without their pigs and, of course, go hungry and whatever. So by the early 1890s, people have started to immigrate from Haiti like crazy. It gets to be over a million of them. And so right now there is a large politically effective Haitian diaspora, which has impact back on Haiti, affects elections, sends money back down there. The diaspora has become quite important. Jimmy Carter encouraged a pro-democracy movement there, but of course he wasn't in office for more than 4 years, so that ended with the election of Ronald Reagan. For some reason, in 1985, there was in the midst of an alleged election, three people got murdered. Now, in the midst of the two Duvaliers, as I say, tens of thousands of people got killed. But somehow these three murders do it. And the country rises up and throws Jean-Claude Duvalier out in January of 1986. Duvalier, of course, and his friends have all taken lots of money out of the country, so which doesn't help the economy any. There's a famous Haitian writer, Marie Vieux Chavez, who has a trilogy called Love, Anger, and Madness, which would give you an extremely disturbing feel for life under Papa Doc and the total helplessness that you had. In January of 1991, John Bernard Aristide, a priest, became president, promises sweeping changes in the society. Peasants are all excited. But by September 30th of 1991, the army, which doesn't want any of these changes, throws him out. And in the course of doing this, of course, about 1,200 of his supporters get killed. In 1994, Aristide returns with the help of U.S. troops that were ordered there by Bill Clinton. However, Clinton also supports various neoliberal economic and other policies that make the U.S.-mandated reforms of Haitian political life not work. So, once again, the Americans, not knowing what they're doing, give the Haitians instructions about how to live their lives, and it doesn't work. So, to sort of bring us to where we are, you recall in December of 2010, One of the worst earthquakes ever occurs in Haiti. Lots of people die. The country's devastated. A lot of the main historic buildings in Port-au-Prince are absolutely leveled, etc. So a whole bunch of people come to help them. So at this point, you've got the UN military mission, U.S. aid agencies, all kinds of non-governmental agencies and missionary organizations running around Haiti, trying to fix things, totally uncoordinated with each other. There are so many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that nobody knows how many of them there are, let alone that they have any of them talking to each other. God forbid we should have coordination. So, and they're all at sixes and sevens to each other. After the earthquake, the OAS mission, OAS had a mission there, and after the earthquake, it's the head of the mission, Ricardo Centafos, who's a Brazilian, had this analysis of the situation in Haiti. In his view, the UN should get out. He says, Haiti is not an international menace. There's no civil war. The UN troops only prop up a bankrupt vision for the country. He said, we want to make Haiti a capitalist country, a platform for export to the U.S. market. It's absurd. He favored a return to Haiti's subsistence cultures of agrarian self-sufficiency. He says Haiti must return to what it is, a primarily agricultural country. He said there is a malicious and perverse relationship between the force of the NGOs and the weakness of the Haitian state. He feels that Haiti is basically being used by the NGOs as a place for professionally training young people, young workers. He argues 200 years ago, Haiti illuminated the history of humanity and of human rights. Now we must give Haitians the chance to confirm their vision. He was, of course, removed from his position by the OAS. So that's where we are. Thank you very much for your attention. We have time for a couple questions before people want to wander off to the church.
Those early governments in the first part of the 19th century, where the central debate was whether or not they would be recognized by
Europe or by the United States,
and where the interests of the landholding families and all were subverted by the peasants.
Well,
were those governments white governments or black governments?
See, nothing in Haiti is, may I say, black and white.
And yet it all is.
It's all. So you have the political elites are some leftover white planter families, mulattoes, and some black people who have been successful as merchants and whatever who have become involved. So the political elites are all over. And some of the presidents are black, and some of them are very black, and some of them are not so black. And, of course, they yell insults at each other. I mean, the politicians will yell insults at each other about who's more Haitian than somebody else, and you favor your light-skinned, so you tend to favor the light-skinned people more than the black-skinned people. But some of, course, the light-skinned people have been very supportive of the blacks and vice versa. So nothing in Haiti is clear.
Sure, thank you. Most of those goings-on were all in Port-au-Prince.
Yes.
While the peasants were out.
I mean, some is up in Le Cap, and some is, but, you know, basically, the government's trying to be in Port-au-Prince because that's a bigger city and it's more fun to be in and more French. But there are, you know, there are the only power bases elsewhere until the Americans show up and wipe them out.
Maybe a little question. Did you say that the U.S. recognized Haiti in 1860 or 1862?
1862. Yeah. It's the Vatican is 1860.
There were no Southerners in our government.
Well, that's right. That's right. There was a civil war going on at the time.
Yeah.
And it was just another way to... I'm sure Lincoln decided to thumb his nose at... but it was before the Emancipation Proclamation, which is interesting.
Right.
Paul.
You might want to pay attention to the current news, because tomorrow is a pivotal day in Haiti government. There's been protests since the mid-December when the Prime Minister that resigned over an issue with this, between Martelli and the Senate. There's the elections to re-elect the Senate, which has been delayed. Tomorrow, if nothing is resolved, the government could just be Martelli. It's one out. They're cashing out some kind of an agreement to try to get that settled. And again, to the extent that nothing's happening, the U.S. isn't so happy that the government is not stable yet. So it goes on and on and on.
Yeah,
Mark,
it does.
Thing.
Yes.
Does it export anything today?
Sure. It does export some sugar. It exports coffee, a lot of coffee. It exports bananas. So there is an export economy there.
Is it viable at all?
Well, what's viable? From the pheasant's viewpoint, which is what the Brazilian guy from the OAS is arguing, the vast bulk of the country is, you know, peasants. They want their little land. Let them farm. They can take care of themselves. We're not going to turn it into a giant, you know, United Fruit plantation to sell bananas to the U.S. So just let it alone. So it's viable. The country is viable if left to be Haiti. It's less viable if you try to turn it into something that the Haitians don't want it turned into. Bobby?
Yeah, Bobby, I just wondered if you had any insight into the rice question. I know that...
Oh, they export some rice, too. I'm sorry.
Pardon?
They export rice as well.
Yes, and at one point I think they had a more viable rice economy, but for some reason a lot of U.S. rice, I think because we pay farmers to grow it and all that, a lot of U.S. rice was sent there. And so their farmers sort of had to stand down because they couldn't get the money for their rice. And so now those fields have been dedicated to other things, so they kind of lost their rice economy.
That sounds about right.
In our attempt to do good, sometimes we make a mess. And I think that's a
yes, well, we do it a lot in Haiti.
There's one other economic export, and that's textiles. They're trying to grow a textile industry.
Yes.
As
I say, they at one point they were making all the baseballs. I mean, the U.S. came in and said, "Here, you guys should make baseballs." So they said, "Okay." So they made baseball for a while. Then they found somebody else to make them cheaper or something, and off they went. Yeah.
Is there a mission there by
that?
Or will that be later?
It's always hard to say. Maybe a miracle will happen. You can't help people if you don't understand, you know, what they're about. So the Brazilian guy from OAS's point was about the NGOs, is that Haiti is not a place for amateurs. So for the NGOs to send young people there so they can learn about working in foreign countries is a huge mistake, because they don't speak French, they don't speak Creole, they don't understand the society, they don't understand the history. They don't understand all this, you know, this matrix that I kept talking about. They don't understand any of that, and so they're just sort of flailing around. And so they say, "Well, okay, well, here we'll do this. We'll make baseballs, or we'll grow rice, And then other people are doing other stuff that's contrary to that. So it's whatever aid is getting to them is often totally disorganized. And then to the extent it has to run through Port-au-Prince. Corruption, I mean, when you have a society in which most people don't participate in the political process, the possibilities for corruption are endless. And so money going through Port-au-Prince has a lot of trouble getting out of Port-au-Prince. Our work is entirely different. I mean, we have and Bobby and Tom can speak to this better than I can, and Paul, but we have a village that we're doing sensible things for. We've got built a school for them. We've two schools for them, medical facilities, things that they want. I mean, they want them, right? I mean, that's...
There's a relationship.
There's a relationship.
A 40-year relationship
the LaCroix school, and it's been built over the course of that time, and it gets deeper, richer, and more productive with that relationship. So it is, we're always watching to make sure that we don't do this sort of, just trying to solve their problems. That's not the case. So, but it's.
And we have Pastor Pierre to be the guide on, I think this works for my people, I don't think this works for my people. So, which is helpful. Young lady in the corner, you.
I think I was going to ask.
Oh, okay. All right. Never mind. Okay. That's fine.
Question.
Yeah. All right. Definitely time to go to church. Jim will yell at me.